Hello.
Hello, and welcome to Should I Love This Comic?
My name is Damien Drouet-Whiter.
And my name is Irrigail Drouet-Whiter.
This time we're looking at Uncanny X-Men number 211. Mm-hmm. It has a cover date of November 1986, and it was on sale on the 5th of August 1986. It was available in British newsagents in October 1986, which is when I first bought it. The story is called Massacre, and it's written by Chris Claremont. It's credited as being penciled by John Romita Jr. and Brett Blevins. It's inked by Al Williamson, lettered by Tom Orzechowski, coloured by Glynis Oliver, and edited by Ann Nocenti. The cover, as we're used to now, is two artists. So the main cover image is by John Romita Jr. and Bob Wycheck, with George Roussos colouring it. And then there's the border that we're used to by John Romita Sr., the father of John Romita Jr., as you probably could have guessed. Mm-hmm. And George Roussos again as colourist. And this time we do have a logo designer. It's Jim Steranko. He designed that logo back in the 60s, and it was refined by a Marvel staffer in 1969, and that's the modern version. It was kind of redrawn and given a more professional look, because it was something he just drew within a piece of art originally. So, over our previous episodes, we've been focusing on the Marvel 25th anniversary issues. We've talked quite a lot about Jim Shooter's reign as editor-in-chief and how it was beginning to unravel by 1986. Mm-hmm. So today, we're continuing to talk about that and how Shooter was increasingly alienating his creatives with his decisions and by his demands of changes to stories. Shooter felt he was being caught in the middle, though. So, you know, a lot of people tell stories about Shooter being a bit of a monster, but Shooter talks about being caught in the middle. So he says that his bosses, the owners of Marvel, were making his life difficult. They demanded financial savings and trying to remove benefits from creatives. Jim Shooter was then tasked to pass these new policies on. This is at least part of why Jim Shooter was so unpopular among his creatives. So you get that, don't you? It's a bit like being a middle manager. Mm. You know, you've got to pass on the bad ideas. Mm. And yet, to the person you're passing it on to, it might seem as though you're the creator of the idea. Mm. Particularly if you've got a title that's as descriptive as editor-in-chief, that makes it sound as though you're in charge of everything. Mm. The cost-cutting that was going on had an enormous effect on Marvel's 25th anniversary plans. So we talk quite a lot. This is Marvel's 25th anniversary. They've got the special covers with the borders. Mm. And we've been looking at those issues. They were doing other stuff for the 25th anniversary. And the plan was to launch something called the New Universe. This was to be a line of comics introducing superhero and sci-fi concepts to a world that up to the 22nd of July 1986 was the same as the real world. So it was like a new universe. The idea was it was a real world, and then stuff started happening. Mm. So the point being, you know, within a Marvel comic, you can't do the first aliens. You can't do the first, I don't know, person with superpowers. You can't do, because it's happened so long ago. And actually, with what the Marvel Universe had accumulated by 1986, with things like Eternals that we saw the movie of, mm-hmm. you know, they've got, like, superhero powers and superhero concepts going into, like, the years BC in the Marvel Universe. And alien visitations. Mm. Nothing is... It's not only not new, it's commonplace. Mm. So the idea was that you'd be able to do a more hard sci-fi kind of version of superheroes. Mm. So Shooter obviously wanted to get his top writers and artists onto these new books and claims he intended to pay bonuses equivalent to the royalties that would be earned on a best-selling book in order that the top creatives would be willing to risk moving onto these new books. Mm-hmm. This was an important consideration for a top-level artist. In 1986, Uncanny X-Men, which is what we talked about today, was Marvel's top-selling book, and it averaged 652,000 copies per issue. And Marvel paid royalties on any sales above 100,000 copies. So they were getting like 500,000 copies worth of royalties or more. Mm. The entire top 10 books were selling way above 500K. Mm. So each creator was making approximately 10,000 a month in royalties. So they're getting paid for the work they're doing. They're getting paid per page, whatever they get paid. And then they're making the royalties on how much it's selling. Now, because they were talking about something new and something different, it might not sell as well.
Mm.
So it was entirely possible that these new universe books might fall closer to the Marvel average, which was only 250,000. So you're asking somebody to go from a series where they were getting 10,000 a month to a series where they wouldn't get any royalty.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get them to do them, the idea was to pay them that as a bonus for doing these books. And the hope is by getting the best people to do it, then the sales would increase and the company would make that money back.
Mm-hmm.
That's a theory. Mm-hmm. And this is what Shooter claims. Now, there's always questions about what he claims and what was true. So obviously this initially was no problem. Shooter was given a budget of $250,000 to launch the new universe.
Mm.
Which would have enabled him to get top creators on the book. So he was looking at all the top people at Marvel. But then apparently, as part of a cost-cutting exercise, because they were interested in selling Marvel comics on, the people who owned Marvel halved the amount of money he had. And that suddenly meant he only had enough money to pay the people to make the books and to get them published. He didn't have the money to like give bonuses and stuff like that. So to save money, the books were all but one, so there was one that wasn't, but all the others were written by people who worked on staff at Marvel. Most of them were editors.
Mm.
And they were mostly drawn by new artists, but they did get three artists to come over from top 10 books. And those were Ron Frenz, who came from Amazing Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
Herb Trimpey, who came from G.I. Joe, which was one of the top books at the time. Which I always forget because G.I. Joe was never released on newsagents in the UK.
Mm.
And I think that was because they reprinted it under the Action Force comic. Because mm-hmm. G.I. Joe the toy was Action Man in the UK.
Mm.
So you never saw them on newsstands. And I always forget it's one of the best-selling Marvel books because I never even saw it.
Right.
And the other person they brought was, who went on to New Universe, was John Romita Jr. from Uncanny X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
Now, none of these artists stayed on these new books for long. Herb Trimpey did two issues of Spitfire. Ron Frenz did three issues, and John Romita Jr. did six. Now, in interviews, Romita has described this era as a time he was lied to by Marvel. It seems he was promised no loss of income and a prestigious, well-promoted new series, and he got none of that. So it sounds like, from what he's being told,
mm-hmm.
he was told he would earn as much on this new series, Star Brand, as he did on X-Men.
Mm.
So he was stolen from X-Men by the editor-in-chief who's writing that book.
Mm.
And then he doesn't get the extra money. So obviously some of that was outside of Marvel's control. The new universe launched in the same month, and these books came out the same month actually, as DC's Man of Steel, which was reimagining Superman. So, and that was by John Byrne, who was the biggest selling artist at the time. So DC, in the month when all these new comics were released, released what at the for a long time was the best selling DC comic for like 40 years.
Mm.
Since the days of the war, when they were selling millions and millions of comics, it was the best that DC had ever sold.
Mm.
So compared to that, everything else comes in second. You know, like if you release a new Avengers film, it's not a good time to release a new movie because you're going to be second, you're not going to be first.
Mm.
Which again, you know, I'm sure is why DC decided to schedule that to launch on Marvel's 25th anniversary, because they knew when that was.
Mm.
Everybody knew when Marvel's 25th anniversary was, because everybody knew when it started.
Mm.
But there is no doubt the new universe was hobbled by the combination of a lack of top talent and therefore a lack of perceived importance. So part of the problem is because the funds were cut, they had to get younger people, less experienced people, either that or like people who were past their best and weren't like fan favourites anymore. Mm. They had to get cheaper creatives. And because they did that, everyone went, oh, well, this isn't important. You know, if they've got Frank Miller and John Byrne and George Perez like they did at DC on Wonder Woman and, you know, John Romita Jr. and Chris Claremont, people have been like, oh, this is important. Mm. This is all the top guys. But they didn't. They got a load of assistant editors to write them and they ended up with new artists, some of whom have turned out to have huge, successful careers, but doing their first work when they're not at their best. So, the failure of the new universe and its position as a Jim Shooter project is definitely seen as a contributing factor to him being fired by Marvel in 1987. So, you know, as we look at Uncanny X-Men 211, we can see the fallout of the new universe. Mm. The penciler John Romita Jr. has to leave the book he's been drawing for 3 years to move over to Star Brand. And the book is listed as co-penciled by Brett Blevins, so if you look at the credits in the book, It says, you know, penciled by John Romita Jr. and Brett Blevins. Now, as far as I can tell, and from interviews and stuff, It's almost entirely done by Brett Blevins. Mm-hmm. John Romita Jr., basically what he did was he did the character designs. Mm. And then it was drawn by Brett Blevins. Mm. And the reason he's credited is something that apparently happened quite a few times. I read about it in an interview quite recently about Legion of Superheroes. Mm. So in this period of time, as well as selling at newsagents, comics are being sold in speciality shops, in comic shops. Mm. And comic shops, when they buy a comic, you can't return it. Mm. So at a newsagent, you say, oh, we'll have, I don't know, 100 comics for like this area. Mm. And those 100 comics are given to them by the publisher. And any they don't sell, they return and they get the money back. Mm. With a comic shop, they can't return it. Mm. Unless it's not as described. So something that they did, and they definitely did it with Legion of Superheroes. There was a thing in Legion of Superheroes where Keith Giffen, who was the most popular artist they'd ever had, left. And for a few more issues, it says that he does layouts. And for some of those issues, he had nothing to do with the book. And it is true, he said in interviews, it wasn't me. But DC wrote that he did layouts and asked the artist who drew it to say that he did layouts in order that it couldn't be returnable because that would cost them money. And I suspect in this case, John Romita Jr.'s name is on the book because he was removed at last moment. And they'd already announced he was going to draw it. Mm. And if he didn't draw it, then they have to take returns. And it's the best-selling book for Marvel. So even if only 20% of them decide to make returns, that could be a lot of money gone from their bottom line. Mm. So, you know, I don't think he drew anything that we see on the page here. But, you know, it is something I've never seen it fully confirmed. There's just people have said. But what's interesting about this book, not only has it suddenly had its artist pulled out, which is unusual, but also it's a really major point in the X-Men. Mm-hmm. So the writer Chris Claremont is beginning a huge change in direction for the X-Men. And he's losing his artist right in the midst of it, not gaining a replacement for almost a year. In part because of the creative flight to DC Comics caused by Shooter's behaviour. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's nearly a year from this point. It's issue 218. No, I'm lying. Yeah, 218 is the first issue drawn by the next artist. Mm-hmm. So from 211 to 217, it's all villains. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a long period of time to not have an artist on the top book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're really at a point of change. Chris Claremont believed that with a book, a long-running book, what you had to do is change the team a lot. And he'd done changes before, and the whole purpose of the Mutant Massacre was to change the X-Men. So characters are injured so that they can leave and go off and do other stuff and new characters can come in. And we're going to see that when we look at the book today.
Mm.
Which we've already read, haven't we, darling?
We have.
We have. So, Uncanny X-Men, issue 211.
It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
We open in the Morlock Tunnels, a mile beneath Manhattan, where Scrambler, Arclight, Harpoon, Vertigo, Grey Crow and Riptide, the Marauders, are killing every Morlock they can find. They interrupt a dinner, killing everyone there. Callisto, the ex-leader, arrives with the other Morlock and promises that the Marauders will die. We cut to Professor Xavier's school for gifted youngsters, where the X-Men and New Mutants are catching up on their chores. Wolverine offers to help Colossus and Rogue, stacking the barn, but Rogue reminds him he is recovering from his recent injury and needs to take it easy. Wolverine is not a good patient and slashes at a fork in frustration. We cut from there to Shadowcat and Magneto in the kitchen. They discuss Kitty's haul of junk food and her studies. She has a term paper due, and Magneto, the new headmaster, is determined she should do well. Again, we cut back to Wolverine. He is walking back to the house when he's interrupted by Nightcrawler teleporting in. Like Wolverine, he was recently injured in battle, and he nearly collapses after using his power. They agree that the best remedy is to go and get drunk, but before they can decide who is paying, a monstrous Morlock tunnels up beneath them and dies. Back in the infirmary, Nurse Sharon Friedlander assesses his wounds, and the telepath Psylocke relays his last thought. The Morlocks are being massacred. The X-Men's leader, Storm, is also the Morlocks' leader, so she's going to take the team into the tunnels, but she wants to leave Magneto to protect the school and the New Mutants. Illyana teleports the X-Men to the Morlock tunnels, where they immediately find an injured Callisto and many dead Morlocks. Instantly, Vertigo attacks, disorientating them. Then Riptide moves in. The invulnerable Colossus and Rogue protect the team, and Nightcrawler teleports to kick Riptide in the head. He then grabs Vertigo and teleports her around the tunnel to disorientate her. This works, but it leaves Nightcrawler vulnerable to Riptide, who attacks before he can get away. Riptide and Vertigo escape. Storm orders Illyana to take the injured back to the mansion and orders her not to bring the New Mutants. The remaining X-Men and Callisto go in search of the Marauders. Grey Crow and Arclight kill Annalee and some children she was protecting, and are then set upon by Colossus and Shadowcat. Arclight buries Colossus in rubble, but Grey Crow can't hurt Shadowcat, as she can become as insubstantial as a ghost. The other X-Men lead the remaining Morlocks to safety, but are nearly hurt by Cyclops' optic blast. Wolverine confirms that X-Factor are in the tunnels, but before they can get together, Colossus breaks through a wall, blocking the way. Annalee dies in Callisto's arms as the Marauders attack again. Scrambler tries to disrupt Storm's powers, but she no longer has them, and is able to punch him into Callisto. Riptide attacks to save Scrambler. Harpoon gets Colossus, and Scrambler touches Rogue, disrupting her power. Harpoon then tries to get the powerless Rogue, but Shadowcat phases the energy weapon through them. A recovered Colossus approaches Riptide and breaks his neck, turning to go after Harpoon, and Rogue is shocked that Colossus has killed someone. Storm goes to help Shadowcat up and discovers that she can't re-solidify her body. Rogue wants revenge, but Storm decides that they must get the wounded to safety. She gets Wolverine to stay behind to capture a prisoner for interrogation, but lets him know she only needs one prisoner. the end.
Things happening here today. A show of strength with your boys brigade. I'm so happy and you're so kind. You want more money, of course I don't mind. To buy nuclear tanks was for Tommy Twines. And the public gets what the public wants. But I want nothing, the society's got. So I'm going underground. What if the brass bands play a few start to pound? Going underground. What if the boys all sing? What if the boys all shout?
So quite a lot happened in that issue.
Mm.
Lots of back and forth, lots of characters.
Mm.
What would you say is your initial reaction to the comic?
It's quite wordy. There are a lot of people in it. Certainly on Marvel Unlimited, the graphics were quite confusing.
I think they are at times. I mean,
So that example that you gave of the warlock coming out the ground.
Yeah.
I didn't get that at all. I didn't understand that at all. But then maybe
he tunneled up.
Maybe looking at it now from on the page, which I'm doing, yeah, maybe that's more self-explanatory.
I mean, you do get that thing. I think it's very true on Marvel Unlimited where you do panel view, which is your choice.
Yeah.
And I'll quite often use panel view on Marvel Unlimited because it's a bit too small when you're looking at the whole page because it gets smaller than a normal comics page, even on the laptop, which is what we were using. What can happen is individual panels can become more confusing because you're seeing details they didn't intend you to notice.
Mm. Mm.
And when they're drawing a whole page, they're drawing your attention to things.
Mm.
And you can get like maybe not mistaken, but kind of you get drawn in by something else and you're like, quite what's happening?
Mm.
I mean, a lot happens in this story. A lot of characters are introduced.
Mm.
Because it's Chris Claremont, as you say, it's very wordy and his style is wordy.
Yeah.
And we've talked a lot about wordiness within this era.
Mm.
You know, the Alpha Flight issue written by Bill Mantlo is very wordy. The X Factor issue written by Louise Simonson.
Mm.
We've talked about how that was a trend.
Mm.
And it's a trend that very much starts with Chris Claremont. He's the first wordy. Okay. Well, maybe not the first, but he's like the biggest star.
Mm.
And because X-Men is the best selling comic book, it becomes the standard.
Mm.
And some of it is down to the Jim Shooter of it all. You know, we've talked a lot about him over the previous episodes, and he had this big thing about you have to introduce every concept in the comic every time it comes up.
Yeah.
In case somebody's reading it for the first time. And this was my first US issue of Uncanny X-Men.
Yeah.
And I knew who all these characters were.
Mm.
You know, it was complex and I had to reread it.
Right.
But I knew who everyone was. And it wasn't... I don't think for me it was a barrier to getting into it.
Okay.
But maybe that was because I liked the complexity.
Mm.
But it does make it exceptionally wordy. Because you've got these characters, and this is the first appearance. The Marauders we see there on page one.
Mm.
The only one who's pre-appeared is Vertigo. She's a pre-existing character from a previous X-Men comic.
Yeah.
Everybody else, so we've got Scrambler, Arclight, Harpoon, Grey Crow, as I'm calling him.
Mm.
We'll discuss that later. And Riptide are all brand new characters.
Mm.
You know, and there are other brand new characters within the Marauders who we see in other books.
Mm.
And because of the way we've been reviewing this, not necessarily going in order, we've already seen some of them.
Mm.
So we've seen, we've already seen Blockbuster. Mm. You know, the big guy before
Hulk.
Yeah. And we saw Prism, another new one. Oh, and we also saw Sabretooth, but he's another pre-existing character.
Okay.
So there's like two pre-existing characters, Vertigo and Sabretooth, but everyone else is new.
Mm.
So over these first few pages, he's got to introduce all these characters.
Yeah.
So it starts with these are their names. And actually, very quickly, in that first two pages, he shows the powers of Grey Crow, that he can do that thing where he takes apart and builds any weapon just from what's attached to him. It shows Riptide and what his power is. Mm. It shows Scrambler, that he stops people's superpowers happening.
Mm.
I think we're having to go on to page 4 to get the others. Oh, that's where we get Arclight, and then we get Harpoon.
Mm.
So I suppose over the first 6 pages you get an introduction, oh, and then Vertigo. Mm. So yeah, you get, over the first, it's 5 pages, you get to see the powers of all the characters, and they're all introduced.
Mm.
But it's taken a lot of writing.
Mm.
And you've also had to bring in Callisto. You've had to introduce the concept of the Morlocks, which is only vaguely introduced.
Mm.
And then suddenly we're turning the page and we're at the X Mansion.
Mm.
So there is a lot going on. And it is complex.
Mm.
And then when you get to the X Mansion, nobody's in their superhero costumes. And you've got to introduce them as people.
Mm.
And what's going on in their lives. And then, like, a few pages later, they're then in the Morlock tunnels, and he starts explaining their powers and stuff. It is very complex, I would say.
Mm.
But would you say you enjoyed it?
I'm
intrigued to know.
I don't think I enjoyed it, but there was a little bit of me that felt invested in their story.
I think one of the things that Claremont does well, and some of it is down to all those words, is he's very good at showing you people's feelings.
Mm.
And you feel for the characters quite quickly. Mm. I know this is my first X-Men, as I say, my first US X-Men. Mm. But I've been reading Marvel UK, and the Marvel UK series I read up to this point featured reprints of Power Pack. Right. And within Power Pack, they'd met the Morlocks, they'd met Shadowcat, they'd met Nightcrawler, so two of the X-Men. And they'd met Annalee, who dies in this issue. They met her within those stories that I read in Marvel UK. So I knew these characters, or some of them. So I came in with a bit, even though it was my first, I knew some of the characters and I had feelings about them. Particularly the Morlocks. There was the story with Power Pack and the Morlocks is a bit unusual. And it features some of the, when we talked about X Factor, it featured a series of characters who have some of the worst names and personalities from a stuck in the 80s perspective. You know, we discuss that, don't we? We always talk about, was it acceptable in the 80s? They were introduced in that Power Pack issue. But it meant there were characters in here I cared about who died. So even though I didn't know all these characters, I didn't know who Rogue was. I'd never come across her before. I didn't know who... I think I'd come across Storm, but I didn't know her well. There was enough there maybe to link me, which maybe you didn't have.
Maybe.
I don't know. Should we go to our normal, like, going through titles and scoring and see if that helps us come up more easily with... Let's go through our scoring and see if that'll help us more easily come to a judgment on the issue.
Okay.
So we always talk first about accessibility. How easy is the book for a new reader? What do you think?
I thought it was reasonably easy.
So we score out of 5. Where would you go?
4.
Do you know what? I scored it a 3 when I was reviewing it. And I think I'm going to stick with the 3.
Fair enough.
Because I think you need some pre-existing knowledge of the concepts behind the X-Men. I think you need to know the thing about mutants and they're feared and hated by the general population. I think it definitely helps if you know some of the characters.
Yeah, there was a sort of like, there was a thing at the beginning where someone says the people who live underground.
The Morlocks.
The Morlocks, they're living underground because they're feared and loathed by...
Yeah, I suppose it is there.
But that's not expanded on. You'd have thought that you would have thought that they wouldn't have got Marauders and the other people's, the other lot.
Yeah, I mean, definitely Morlocks, Marauders, not hugely different names. That adds a layer of confusion.
That, sort of, I mean, somebody didn't think about that too strongly.
Yeah, I mean, Morlocks, obviously, the name's... Well, not obviously. The name is taken from H.G. Wells' The Time Machine.
Ah.
They're a group of people in that.
Are they? Oh, okay. And Marauders are just Marauders.
Yeah, Marauders is just a word for horrible people.
Mm.
It's sometimes used for piracy, and actually Marvel use it later, and currently there is a comic book called Marauders that stars the main character as Shadowcat, or Kitty Pryde, who's in this as one of the victims of the Marauders.
Mm.
And she runs a superhero team called the Marauders.
Okay.
Who ride around on a pirate ship.
Who are
indeed.
One has to say "oar" every time.
Arr. Pieces of eight. But yeah. No, I think that's fine. I think me giving it a 3 and you giving it a 4, that's 7 out of 10. Yeah. I think that's... To me, that's reasonable. It's it's better than middling, but it's not amazing for a newcomer.
No.
I think you do need some context.
Mm.
How about artwork? Should we talk about artwork for scoring?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, the elephant in the room that I've talked about already is I don't think that John Romita Jr. had very much to do with this story. Okay. He's credited as an artist, but... It looks almost entirely Brett Blevins and Al Williamson.
Okay.
So what did you think of the art? Were you impressed?
I liked...
Not the cover, we're doing the cover later.
Oh yeah, we are doing the cover later.
We do that separately, it's a separate score.
Okay. I mentioned to you earlier on that I liked the front panel.
Yeah, the first splash page, the original panel. Yeah. Where you can see... And actually, you know, if all that John Romita Jr. did on this was the character designs, which we know he did actually, years later they released an X-Men special that was all character designs over the years, and it had John Romita Jr.'s original character designs for these characters.
Okay.
And the asymmetric outfits, you know, they've all got outfits that are like one shoulder only. Well, not all of them, but most of them. Okay. And that's like a look. And they've all been designed to look very different. And that actually means they look very different in silhouette as well. Which, you know, often people say that's one of the most important things with a comics character is that you should recognise them in silhouette, not just, you know, when you can see their costumes and their hair and stuff.
Yeah.
But they are well designed and they're very varied. And they're varied, you know... from cultural and racial backgrounds as well, which again I think is an attempt. It's an attempt at bringing in some positive representation. I mean, obviously they're villains, and I, you know, we do have the issue. Harpoon is coloured in a very slightly disrespectful to Indigenous Canadians. He's the one who's described as an Eskimo.
Oh, okay. Well,
yes, which again is a word we don't use.
Yeah, but we would have used
the character that. I've referred to as Grey Crow, because that's what they call him now. In this comic, he's referred to as Scalp Hunter.
And is that that one?
Yeah, which again hasn't aged very well for a Native American character.
No.
And I think there is some caricaturing on the Korean character on Scalp Hunter.
Okay.
No, not Scalp Hunter. Scrambler. Scrambler is the Korean.
I don't know. I would not have tweaked. Tweaked. That.
Okay, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think the name gives that one away. And there's a reference to him being Korean later on with...
Okay.
I think it's very interesting that Scrambler's outfit is basically just what a cool fella might wear in 1986.
All right.
You know, he's wearing a loose-fitting jacket with kind of parachute pants.
Yeah.
in a way, his outfit, if you coloured it differently, I could see David Byrne wearing that in a Talking Heads video.
And I was going for, you know, sort of David Bowie kind of.
Mm. Yeah, the one shoulder thing has got a.
The makeup thing.
Yeah, yeah, true.
If that's supposed to be makeup, I don't know.
But anyway, let's talk more about the arcs. Talk more about the character designs than the art.
Yeah.
I think it's very effective.
Yeah.
I think it's very good. I think he, you know, I think Brett Blevins sells the action. You can see which character's doing what when.
Mm-hmm.
You can also, you know, you get the emotional beats work. The bit where Annalie is, like, begging to save the children. Mm. And then later on when she dies in Callisto's arms, you know, the anger on the face of Colossus when he turns to violence, which is unusual for him, that I think he does a really good job of selling it. But I scored this 4 out of 5 because Brett Blevins is one of my favourite comics artists.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Williamson, I think, is probably his best inker. And at the time, they were sharing a studio and they were working together very closely and doing great work.
Mm.
But in the month that this is released, Brett Blevins draws 4 comic books for Marvel.
Mm.
And I think this is rushed. I don't think this is his best work. Mm. Now, obviously, 4 comic books coming out doesn't mean that you drew them all in 1 month.
Mm.
You know, one of the books was a every 2 month book. You know, but I think he had too much work, and I think this was done as a favour, as a pretty much overnight job, because I think John Romita Jr. was removed from the book at very short notice.
Mm.
And I think this is good, but it's not as good as Brett Blevins can do.
Mm.
You know, and particularly Brett Blevins inked by Al Williamson, so I've given it a 4, which I still think is a good score out of 5.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, they look convincing when they're in normal clothing.
Yes.
Which is something a lot of comics artists can't do, you know.
Yeah, and I sort of like, and certainly with the Wolverine, I think they've... It's difficult to take away the Wolverine from films now, and that's quite clearly, so, you know, quite clearly a Wolverine classic, or...
Yeah, I mean, the character's older than Hugh Jackman was.
Yeah.
And kind of more grisly. But he's got so much characterisation, I think that's really well done.
And I guess... Yeah. That kind of confused me, the whole...
Oh, the bit with the crocodiles following the Piper.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a pre-existing... Piper was a character who'd appeared in Power Pack and Thor.
Okay, but he
seems... Stories.
He seems to have done nothing. He seems to do a bit
of... Well, he's calling the bats in to attack them.
Oh, is he? Oh, okay.
To make them go away. But yeah, if you move on a bit, we're just looking at 1 or 2 pages here.
And crocodiles.
You know, just to show how great the art can be. And I think, you know, they clearly spent more time on some bits than others.
Mm.
But, you know, I think, like, that page, the lighting on that page, what number is it? Page 14. We'll get this up. If you go to our blogspot, shouldilovethis.blogspot.com, you can see pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way that that scene is done, so him coming through the doorway, Annalie begging, you can really tell what she's trying to do. That she cares for those children. And then the shadows when the arc light and Grey Crow are just stood there. And then you've got that amazing shadow on the image of Colossus about to throw a great big rock at them. It really is. Okay. There's stunning work there that shows what they can do. You know, it shows their ability.
Mm.
Even something as simple, I think there's a bit later on that I thought was, like, this page of the fight.
Mm.
Where they're fist fighting between Scrambler and Storm and Callisto has got a real energy and a real...
Okay.
you know, I mean, Brett Blevins is a great artist. And Al Williamson was a great artist before Brett Blevins was even born.
Mm.
You know, Al Williamson was a classic artist. He was someone who came up, he'd drawn Flash Gordon for like decades and stuff. Mm. He really was a classic artist, and I think they do amazing work here.
Mm.
But for me, it's 4 out of 5. What are you going with? Because I know it can be even greater. Which might be unfair, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so. 4 out of 5.
You're going 4 out of 5 as well.
Yeah.
Another high scoring one. Next one we normally do is characterization. Do we know who these people are? Do we care about them? Do we understand their motivations?
Not really. Would be my...
What is it that you feel you don't understand? I'm intrigued to know.
I don't understand the backstory.
Whose backstory?
The whole kind of Marauders, X-Men.
One thing that is true is that the Marauders had never appeared... They appeared in issue 210, so the issue before.
Mm.
But they appear in the shadows hunting someone down to try and find the Morlock tunnels.
Mm.
And you don't actually see them properly.
Mm.
So they're introduced in this issue. And you don't know who they're working for. You find out about that in the next issue.
Mm.
You don't get to see their leader for like 10 issues.
Mm.
So there is a lot of mystery there. There's a lot you don't know about the characters.
Mm.
And in many ways, each of the Marauders at this point doesn't have a personal kind of motivation. No. You can't tell the difference between, you know, Grey Crow's motivation and Scrambler's motivation and Vertigo's motivation and Riptide's other than just wanting to kill people.
And I think, as we say about the films, so both of us kind of turn off when there's a fight. And there's a bit too much fighting in this.
There's a lot of fighting. I think they do the fighting quite well. I think the fighting flows.
Yeah.
And I think the motivation behind what the X-Men do is very strongly there.
Okay.
You know, they're being angered by violence, they're trying to protect people, they're...
Yeah.
None of it feels gratuitous, even though it's really quite violent to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel gratuitous.
No.
And it reveals things about character, I think,
okay,
on the part of the X-Men. Now, I did give it 5 out of 5 for characterization, because I think all of these characters are different people.
Mm.
And they act in ways that are consistent with the character, but may be surprising.
Mm.
You know, Colossus killing someone, and they mention that he doesn't normally kill. You know, there's certain characters who kill, and there's certain characters who would never kill. Mm. And, you know, that kind of being wound up by the situation, you know, the leadership skills, the fear, I think it feels very real to me, but... You're right, the villains don't have modification. So I gave it 5 out of 5. What would you give it out of 5?
I'd give it a 4 out of 5.
Okay, so we end up on a 9 out of 5. We're still saying... Mm. 9 out of 10, sorry. We're still going quite well. I see you're looking, which I will be sharing on our blogspot, the Marvel Mutant Massacre map, which is the how to read the Marvel Mutant Massacre.
Oh, okay.
And it's got the order to read it in, which isn't really an order, with all the pictures. It's drawn by Walter Simonson.
Okay.
And he designed it as well. So it started in X-Men 210, which was the issue before.
Okay.
And X-Factor number 9, which was the issue before X-Factor we did. And they were just introductions. So both of those, you knew stuff was going on, but you didn't know what it was.
Okay.
We've read X-Factor 10, we've read Thor 237, we've read X-Men 211.
Have we?
Now. Yeah, that okay. one's that's what we're reading today.
Oh, is it? Okay.
We've done that one, we've okay. done that one. Okay. We're not going to do any of the others of those because they're not from this month.
Okay.
But it's like a little map, and it's really quite fun. And this is the first crossover, the first mutant crossover. And it's a big deal. This becomes a big deal. And we should really talk about this. Because it's quite interesting in kind of the Marvel Universe. This is the first time they do a crossover, and the reason they do the Mutant Massacre is, can you guess why?
Because they want to sell more comics?
No.
Oh, because they want
What happens is, back in about issue, I think it's about issue 170 of X-Men, around about that era, it might be 169, Chris Claremont introduces the Marauders. Not the Marauders, he introduces the Morlocks. You see, I'm making that mistake now. Exactly. The Morlocks, who live in the tunnels. And they're led by Callisto, and he introduces a couple of other characters who are main characters. And it's drawn by an artist called Paul Smith. Now, Chris Claremont's idea is that it's a small group of people who live in the tunnels. Mm. So maybe 10, 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
In that first appearance, Paul Smith draws crowd scenes of like 100 characters. And then they go to appear again, and people are adding extra characters and extra characters. You get more and more named characters. And basically, for Chris Claremont, the idea's got too big. So one of the things he wants to do is he wants to make the Morlocks smaller. He wants it to almost be like a found family living in the tunnels. And he wants it... I mean, it was designed kind of as a... like an analogous to homeless people.
Okay.
Like working together to look after each other. You know, it was almost a class thing in a way that, you know, often the analogy that you get for mutantdom is things like racism and sexism and homophobia, anti-Semitism. And you want to do something that's more about a class thing. So you've got the beautiful mutants in the X-Men, and then you've got these kind of weirdos living underground who aren't really accepted. So he decides to kill some of them off to make it more reasonable again. And apparently he was talking about this with Louis Simonson, who was the writer of X-Factor and Power Pack. And she says, well, that's too good an idea to be one issue of X-Men. We should do crossovers to this. And he's like, oh, well, I don't mind. Why don't you do some? And she's married to Walter Simonson. And he writes Thor, so Thor ends up in it. And there's actually an issue of Daredevil ends up in it. Not the one we read, but the issue afterwards. That's written by Anne Nocenti, who's the editor of this. So they basically create a crossover by accident. Because a group of four people, who are all writers, but are all also involved in X-Men, get together and say, oh, why don't we just do bits of your story with our story, and we can tie it in, and we can do things about what we want to do. We can bring elements of that in. And they say, can we do a crossover? And apparently, like, the following year, they get told you're doing a crossover. By, like, the powers that be, by the editor-in-chief. Because it sells really, really well. So they're not doing it to make money, it's the other way around. They're doing it because they're like, well, that story's too big for one issue. So that was characterization, and we've talked about the map for ages. Should we talk about the cover?
Yeah.
Which character is it?
It is Wolverine.
It's Wolverine!
Yay.
And he's been in the wars, his mask's all shredded.
It is.
And who's it drawn by?
John Ramirez.
It's John Romita Jr.
Yeah.
So it's signed JRJR
yeah.
and Bob Wycheck.
Oh, okay.
What do you think of this cover? Do you like it?
I do.
It's pretty good, isn't it? It's very different from the other face pictures we've had so far. The other ones have been very much about, you know, just showing the character's face. And this is an action shot. He's about, he's in a fight. And I think it's clear as well that this was drawn before the issue.
Okay.
So they knew there was going to be a major fight scene and Wolverine would be in it.
Okay.
And it was all going to be about fighting, but it's drawn by John Romita Jr., who ends up not drawing the comic. And it's a very different image of Wolverine comparative to, you know, what appears in the comic. His costume doesn't get damaged in that way.
No.
In the comic. But it's a great action shot. And I like the way they did the light reflecting off the claws.
Yes.
So what would you give that as a score out of five, that cover?
Four.
You're giving it a four. I gave it a five. I really like this cover. Yeah, I really like it. I even like the fact that he's looking upwards. Because obviously Wolverine's meant to be much shorter than a lot of other characters.
Oh, okay.
Which is something you did lose in the movies, because obviously Hugh Jackman is over 6 foot.
It's huge.
And Wolverine was meant to be short, because the idea it's like a Wolverine. Like a small... Because Wolverines are like badgers or something. You know, they're like small but vicious.
They're not badgers.
They're not badgers, but they're more like a badger than... Sometimes people compare them to wolves because of the Wolverine.
Yeah.
But they're nowhere near the size of a wolf.
A common mistake, apparently.
Yeah, apparently so. But no, it's really good cover. It's action shot. I love John Romita Jr.'s art anyway, and I'm a fan of Bob Wiacek as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it really sells it, and it tells you something important's happening in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's violent, and that it's Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Wolverine's the big star of X-Men at this point. Mm-hmm. I quite like the colouring as well. I like the red background against his brown costume.
Mm-hmm.
And the red on the logo. I love that logo. I said designed by Jim Steranko. Mm-hmm. We talked about that. And then refined by people within Marvel Editorial. Real classic logo.
Mm.
I even quite like that corner box, even though it's not the best. They're all drawn by John Romita Jr. and Dan Green on those. The kind of head images of all the characters.
Yeah.
But no, I think it works really well.
40p.
40p, I know they were all 40p at that point. That's how come I bought so many of these back in 1986. Even with very little money. So our last category is the one where we take points off and it's acceptable in the 80s. Is there anything in here that was acceptable in the 80s that isn't acceptable now? I think you can guess what I've taken points off for, at least one of the things.
Skull...
Yes, Grey Crow. Let's call him Grey Crow.
Grey Crow.
And I do think that the depiction of Harpoon is not appropriate. I think even in 1986, people knew you weren't meant to say Eskimo.
Okay. I'd have called him Eskimo back then, but, you know.
Yeah, I probably would as well, but I was 12.
And I was...
You were 11.
11.
You know, we had an excuse for having a lack of knowledge. This is being published by a huge publishing house.
Mm.
I think that one's got two. And I actually took 2 points off because the second thing I took points off for is I think they fell into something, and it's something Brett Blevins does quite often, even though he's a great artist. They do the sexy woman in peril thing, and the sexy where it shouldn't be sexy quite a few times.
Oh,
so there's a young girl at the dinner at the beginning where the massacre starts.
Oh yeah.
There's a girl who dies. And she dies looking sexy.
Oh.
I can't find her now.
Where? You know.
I can't find her in the book. I want to show you, darling.
When I die, I want
to. Yeah, there. I think they try and make her look a bit sexy.
I want to die sexily.
I mean, you probably will, because you do everything sexily.
You
and there's also a scene with Kitty Pryde, who is meant to be 15.
Is she?
Okay. Yes. I know she looks older than 15, which always harms that. But I think she's drawn in quite a sexualized style, including where she goes through the ceiling, so you get a nice up the skirt shot.
I briefly took that.
I think that probably is not appropriate.
Well,
You know, violence with sexiness.
Mm.
It's not a good combination, I think. You know, and it is a problem in comics. It happens a lot. Where people draw people, you know, who are meant to be in pain but look like they've stepped out of a porn video. You know. And I think sometimes the artist has used porn as a reference.
Oh.
I don't think Brett Levins does that. I think he just tends to draw things quite sexy. Okay. I think that's his style.
Okay.
So I took off 2. Would you take anything off?
Yeah, I'd take off 1.
So that's 3 off. So we're on 7 plus 8 plus 9 plus 9. Quick maths, 26. 34 minus the 3 is 31. So that actually puts us in 5th place.
Oh, okay.
So we will still have Thor at number 1. The issue of Thor we did. We enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Then the Avengers. Then Conan.
Yeah.
Then Daredevil, which was on 31.5.
Okay.
Ooh. Then this on 31. Then Amazing Spider-Man, then Fantastic Four. Then Web of Spider-Man, then X-Factor at the bottom.
Oh, wow.
In ninth place. And X-Factor's still at the bottom because of all the deductions.
Okay.
Because they had a lot of characters who had incredibly racist names.
Mm.
Which is unfortunate, because it's actually quite a good comic.
Mm.
And they got a 10 out of 10 for art, I think.
Okay.
I think.
Mm.
And for, no, I think cover was a bit lower, but anyway.
No.
So, the question remains, the podcast called Should I Love This Comic? Should I Love the Uncanny X-Men number 211?
Do you still love it?
I do. I still love it. I think it's exceptionally well written. I think this is Chris Claremont at his best.
Okay.
I would say the run from about issue 170 of Uncanny X-Men to around about issue, at least issue 250. Beyond there, he starts rowing with the editor who he's working with, who isn't Ann Senti anymore. And things get rewritten and changed against his will.
Mm.
And the work isn't as good because it's not harmonious. Mm. Although there are individual issues that are good beyond that.
Mm.
And some that are very good.
Mm.
But I would say that kind of, the best part of 100 issues in a row, he is on fire.
Mm.
His work is superlative. And I think this is dead in the middle of that. And it is great. And it just really, really good. And I think it's the best work. I think it's well drawn.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the best work they've done. But it was done under time pressure. And I just think it's good. I think it was a good idea for a story. I think what it does to the general story of the X-Men, where three characters leave and other characters come in, is good for the story and takes it to a different place.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoy it.
Good.
Do you think I should love this comic?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty good story. That is our final word on this. So far, we haven't really come across a comic that we've said is awful, have we?
No,
not in this era, which is odd, because we're doing an era. So we're even looking at comics that I've never looked at before.
Mm.
So, plans for the next month or so on Should I Love This Comic? I'm going to take us through. So our next episode, we'll be moving away from the era again and looking at something new.
Okay.
And the plan is to look at a Halloween comic.
Ooh.
I wonder why I chose that.
I have no idea.
No, can't work it out as we record this on the 8th of October. Then, after that, we're going to come back to the 25th anniversary. And my current plan is to go for a reprint comic. Because some of the 25th anniversary was reprints of older stuff. So that's intriguing. And then, I think it might be time then for our Christmas special. Which I have something very special lined up. And we're going to go DC for Christmas this year.
Ooh.
So lots of excitement over the next month or two. The run up to Christmas. That's another 4 episodes that we have to work on.
Yes.
But I'd like to thank everyone who's listening for listening to this episode. I'd like to thank the wonderful Irigel Drury-Whiter, my wonderful husband.
That's all right.
For joining me and talking about it. And should I love this comic?
Yes,
I should. See you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.